welcome to episode 41 of Tabletop Game Talk, a show where we talk about tabletop games of all types. I'm one of your hosts, Kitty.
I'm Chris.
I'm Spencer.
And I'm Sydney.
Today we'll be talking about bringing people into the hobby. We all have non-gamer friends, and today we'll talk about some ways to change non-gamer friends to casual gamers. But first, a thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, Emil Jiljam, Shane Poole, George, and Adam Harrison. A huge thank you to all our patrons as well.
Thank you, Kitty. Welcome back to not the first time listeners, but welcome back to listeners that are not listening for the first time. And if you are a first time listener, normally this is Josh who talks at the beginning, but Kitty's...
But you don't know who that is.
You don't, because you're the first time listener.
It even still says Josh. I would like to point out my on the fly correction of not saying I'm one of your hosts, Josh.
Well, you did a great job at that. And we're doing a great job at keeping those new listeners.
Yeah.
So our first announcement, Josh is not with us today. He is off doing something for Memorial Day. So we brought two people in. This is the first time, this is not our couples episode, but this is an episode done by couples.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
So Chris and Sydney, Kitty and Spencer, we're going to talk about bringing people into the hobby. But I do need to talk first about Mechs versus Minions. I'm giving away my second copy of it. I end up with a second copies of a lot of games. This one I did on purpose. I did order it on purpose because I wanted to give it away. Our deadline for this contest is giveaway. It's not a contest because you don't have to do anything. You just have, well, not anything. You don't have to know anything. There's no skill. You have to go to our website, tabletopgametalk.com, and then click on the giveaways button in the upper right corner. Fill out the form. That's all you have to do. If you've already entered a contest in the past, then you have a little magic link and just click on that and just say, yes, enter me in the Mechs versus Minions contest. And you'll be entered, no problem. It is due by Sydney's birthday.
Woo!
Yay. Which is June 14th. We'll be announcing it at Origins. I still do not have confirmation where our show is going to be at Origins. So it is entirely possible it's going to be in the hall someplace. Follow us on Twitter at TabletopGameTLK, and we will keep you up to date on where we're going to be. Come on, stop over. I've already set up a time. Well, Christy, you need to let me know if that time works for you. But Christy's going to be there, so we're going to play a game with her on Thursday. We'll make it something fun. And we will do, I think June 14th is a Friday. So if I'm, or is it?
June 14th is a Wednesday.
It's Wednesday. When Origins starts.
Oh. The deadline is Wednesday, June 14th. Thank you. We will announce it at our Origins show, which will be that Friday. So you'll hear it on the podcast the Tuesday after June 14th.
Not Wednesday, not Friday.
Not Wednesday.
Next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday. Yes.
All right.
All right. It makes total sense. Follow us on Twitter.
Those first-time listeners, we don't normally just go over a calendar for 5 minutes.
We don't. We should, maybe. No, this is probably
I
don't
think that's a good idea.
Not all right. The first time, though.
All right. One calendar event I do know that's going to happen, and that's Gen Con. It's Friday the 18th, August 18th at 6 p.m. We know this is one's going to happen. So if you're not going to make it to Origins, we will see you at Gen Con. I do need to give a shout out to my D&D group from 5 years ago, the Haitians. We had a reunion, not this weekend, but the previous weekend. And the way our D&D group ended, we're not really sure exactly how it all ended. We just know that Tiamat, which is our 500-headed evil dragon god, and a vampire that they put and fought with each other was how that campaign ended with
no resolution.
No resolution. So we came back literally 5 years later in real time. And then in the campaign, 5 years later, where they had to fight an evil kobold that ended up taking all the power of Tiamat and this vampire into its own little kobold body, who was really, really nice kobold. And he was very, very thankful to the party. He's like, you made me who I am. I'm giving you this really cool item. It's going to, like, you can control undead with it. You're going to love it. By the way, it turns everything that you come close to it dead as well. So no, I mean, no need to thank me.
Nice guy at all.
No. He was just really nice about it. The party was really, really, you know, kind of distraught as they kept hacking away at the kobold. Like, well, wait a minute, why do you keep hitting me? And he's just sitting there. And then eventually, the kobold shell went away, and an undead five-headed dragon came out and started destroying the countryside. Of which the group had to sacrifice themselves to kill the evil undead Tiamat. Anyway, it was a lot of fun. So shout out to all those guys and gals. Kickstarter. Clash of Rage, I finally pulled the trigger on this one. It's a 1-4 player, 5 with an add-on, confrontation game with more than 70 minis, playable in campaign or skirmish mode.
It's a lot of minis.
It is a lot of minis. It looks to me like a Cool Mini or Not game, but it's a different developer. And I've decided to post in the Kickstarter comments of the games I back, because right now I'm just kind of reading their little blurb. So I'm going to put a shout out to the designers, like, hey, we're going to give you a mention on the podcast. If there's something specific you want me to say, let me know, and so I can describe it the way you want it. So they did get back to me, and this is what they say about Clash and Clans. Clash of Rage, not Clash of Clans. That's a completely different game. In Clash of Rage, every player plays a clan willing to take the Emerald Empire back. Fight the elves and the other players. Equip your troops with a large choice of equipment, and be the best strategist to beat your opponents. Clash of Rage offers skirmish mode as well as campaign mode to extend the epic fights on various scenarios. So this one looks really cool. Check it out if you like miniature games. It's on the higher end because it's a miniature game, so you're still talking in that $100 range. But if you like these types of games, and there's lots of how to plays on this one, and lots of like actual plays and stuff that you can watch. Our next one, Role Player, is coming out with their expansion. This is not Yahtzee. I talked to the developer. He said it's not Yahtzee.
Are you sure?
Okay, so we had a talk about this. And I think we figured out where the breakdown is. There's the Yahtzee mechanic, which is rolling a pool of dice, keeping some, and re-rolling others.
Yes.
That is often described as the Yahtzee mechanic. This does not have the Yahtzee mechanic, but it does have a Yahtzee-like element where you roll the dice and then you choose where to place them.
I think Kitty's right.
I'm
I think Chris is right.
Wow. And it starts. Dun, dun, dun. I will agree with Kitty as well. I also,
that's what you get for sticking up. Yeah.
I also may have lied. I was not able to contact the developer on this one, but I did meet him. Sorry. I didn't meet him last year at Gamehole Con. And so that's where I discovered Role Player. But this one is the Monsters and Minions expansion that has been promised for a while. So what happens is you play through the game. And in Role Player, what you're doing is you're rolling dice to create the best role-playing character. And you're placing these dice and try to get maximize and minimize stats in the right spot based on the cards you're drawing and the alignment and the class and all those types of things. And when you're done, it's like whoever optimized the best you get. It's a point salad game at heart, so you get all your points. But that's it. The expansion, now you get to fight monsters. So the final part of the whole scenario is now you take these characters you created and fight these monsters, which is just like a smaller, it doesn't seem like it's like a whole nother game. It's like 10, 15 more minutes. And whoever comes away fighting the monsters gives you extra points, and then you can win by doing that. So I'm really excited about it because it looks really cool. If you haven't played Role Player, you should check this one out, because they are also selling the base game with it. So you can get the base game plus the expansion.
If your favorite part of D&D is rolling the characters, this is a game you should play.
It is. It really is. So, I mean, how many people, if you play D&D, you have rolled up, and I use that term loosely because a lot of times it's point by, but you've rolled up at least 10 times as many characters as you ever got to play.
Oh, yeah.
So might as well play a game with it.
So one of my hobbies in high school is just making role-playing characters. Yeah. I would just sit around all day making characters that I would never play.
Yeah, that's what I did in geometry class. Yeah. I was playing the Hero System, which is a point by superhero game, and I would sit in the back of math class and just write like champions characters in the back of class. I figured that I was learning better math there than whatever was going on the board. I mean, I didn't need to solve for X to get super blast. It would have just worked either way. And the last one, all right, I need to say this right. Owano, which, and that's pronunciation from there. It's U-H. It's like Owano? Owano?
I'd go with Uwanu.
Uwanu? Okay. It's spelled I-U-N-U.
Owano.
It's still spelled I-U-N-U. So this one, I actually asked two questions on this one, because this is one of the longest Kickstarter lengths that I've seen. I think they set it to like 50 days or 45 wow. days. So I asked from the beginning, it's like, one of my questions is, why such a long campaign? And their response was, we'd like to have our campaigns end at the end of a month, and there was not enough time to end it in May. Other than that, even though Todd's games are quite well known on BGG and in the print and play community, they're not what you would call commercially well known. So more poetry than prose, if you will. Therefore, we wanted to make sure that the game had every chance of getting funded, which this game does look like it's going to get funded. It had a relatively, I don't want to say low because I think it was still like in the 20K range, but conservative for what it was funding. Their description of this is a simple, clever, quick game with surprising depth and a minimalistic visual identity for 2 to 4 players. Number 2 in the Sanders Select series. That still doesn't tell you a whole lot about the game. It has kind of this Egyptian feel to it, though. It's mostly just a card game, and I would love to give you more information about it, but just kind of check it out. If you like the visual aesthetics of like clean cards with like these Egyptian hieroglyphics and stuff, it looks really cool. And it looks like it's just a simple card game. But again, simple card game doesn't mean it's not strategically deep. It just means it's easy to learn, which may be a good game to go into today's topic as far as pulling people into the hobby. That said, last week's topic, we did better on that topic than any other show we've ever done.
I was going to say, like, I certainly had no feedback.
Yeah. In fact, none of you had any feedback, which makes me believe that we did fantastic talking about rule books.
We covered it all.
We covered every bit of it. Sydney and I, we woke up in North Carolina this morning, mm-hmm. and on our drive back to the airport, we had a conversation regarding XCOM and whether or not their way of doing rule books is better
or worse. And by rule book, you mean tutorial.
Tutorial, non-rule book. Yeah, this is what we talk about in our spare time.
So are you going to follow my suggestion of making a 15-part series on rule books more in depth?
I think we should. And yeah. and we're going to go
I think the new listeners will really like
it. Yeah, yeah. So just be prepared. We're not going to limit that to 1 hour because I don't think we can. Like, no. We just have to let that go.
Yeah.
Yeah. See where it goes. Make it happen. We do have a quick question, though.
All right. So let's go to our question from one of our listeners. This is a question that won't fill an entire show topic, but we think is interesting nonetheless. Today's question comes from Jamie. How do you find time and or convince your gaming group to play a really long game, 4+ hours?
So this one is a tricky one. Normally, you just have to say, hey, this weekend, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And then say, come over to my place. We're starting at noon. We probably won't be done until noon on Sunday. But hey, it'll be fun. Trust me.
Or get a group together that has already all played the game and they absolutely want to play it again. They just haven't found the time. You put your time in your calendar 6 months out and you tell everyone we're going to be there on that day to play that game.
Food helps too.
Yes. I'll do pretty much anything for pizza.
Yeah, that's what we did for the D&D reunion because I didn't want to make it just a short thing. And Dungeons & Dragons, normally when you're playing a role-playing game, you expect to play a little bit longer. But these days, like, the average game is still like maybe 2 to 4 hours of a role playing session. So I'm like, all right, come over at noon. We'll have lunch. So I'll make sure there's food here when you get here. Start off with the food. So setup is fine. You're setting up the game. Maybe you refresh the rules as everyone's eating. But don't try to play the game while you're eating food. It's just too distracting, especially at the beginning of
it can get playing. Messy.
Right.
And that way you can clean up afterwards and have more room on the table because games like that usually have a lot of components.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing too is once you've done and you've cleaned up the food, now you're ready to sit down and get to it and you haven't lost any time. So you've set up, everyone has their pieces and stuff, but you're not like, oh, what did I just do? What was going on there? So that's my how to start it. Short and start at noon. I think noon on a Saturday is kind of a good time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you're playing through, set breaks. Okay, at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, we're going to order dinner.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then you order, so that's a quick break. Then you have a good hour or so that you're still playing, but you're also being able to prep and kind of like, okay, we're going to pause.
Well, if you live in the city of Chicago, I would assume that other places might not take an hour for your food to get there.
That's true.
depending on where and what you order. But yeah, it's still, the theory holds.
But finding a good breaking point to do that.
Or if you live like where we live, you can walk across the street, walk into a place that doesn't have any lines, order your Mexican food, come back here, eat it, and then be done.
Now, I will caution that if you all leave the table and you're going to go someplace else, getting back to the game can be a challenge.
Yeah, definitely.
I think you can't leave the apartment, house, whatever. Once you've sat down, you're stuck in the building.
Yep.
No, but that's really hard to do. Now, this might not work for all games, but can't you just try to like break it up? So instead of, there's a game that takes 12 hours to play. You can't get everybody together for that. Say, okay, we're going to have this board set up. Everyone come over for an hour. We'll play a couple rounds or however it works, and then we won't touch it until the next time we get together.
That's actually one of the reasons we bought the table that we are recording on right now, because it actually has an inset that both of us looked at each other when we saw the table, and we were like, we could leave a game in there and just put the glass over it and just leave it that way and come back to it at another point.
Yep. That's great. How often have you done that?
Not a single time. Yeah. And that's another point I want to get at is if you're going to do these long games, it's best to just do a marathon session, because think of how hard it was to get everyone there the first time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you have a regular game group, you can do this, right? You're just like, okay, we're going to play 4 hours and then we're going to break and we're going to do 4 hours. At work, some of my friends just started a game group and they'll play Scythe. They'll play the first half on 1 week and then the second half another week. And they just take a picture of the board. And then when they come back the next week, one person's responsible for setting it all up. And then everyone comes in. It's like, it's right where they left off. Mm-hmm. So that's another way you can go about this as well. But I say just power through. Don't play Twilight Imperium with people who don't really want to play board games. Axis and Allies, it's that classic old school take forever game. It's not for everyone. Mm-hmm. Make sure that everyone is really committed. It only takes
that
one person.
They know what they're getting into.
Yep. Yeah. Because it only takes one person to kind of throw the whole thing off by saying, I'm bored. I don't want to do this. You guys keep going. I'm just going to go watch TV or something like that. Call me when it's my turn.
Yeah. And if you're jonesing to play a game that you can't get a group of people to play with you, usually conventions will have other people that are jonesing to play that same game, and your whole weekend is set aside. So if you're willing to spend most of your time at a convention playing one game, you'll probably find other people there willing to play with you.
Yep. Because some people, that's what they do for conventions. That is their thing. They're going there for one thing. That's not me. Do not ask me to play Twilight Imperium at a convention. Although I may do it at like 10 o'clock at night. I will play a 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. game. I'm okay, because the morning at a convention, I can sleep in anyway.
And the dealer's hall's closed.
And the dealer's hall doesn't open until 10 a.m., so I can do that. But during the day, during dealer hall hours, no. That I have to be flexible. So,
also, you can get together online sometimes. I don't know if you could do this with some board games, but I know with role-playing games, there's a lot of websites out there that are set up to get your group together in a virtual space rather than an in-person place. Yeah.
We are going to do an episode on virtual board games. There's a couple sites out there. Mm-hmm. There's one pay and I think one free. And we're going to do an episode on these because it's not something I've been doing enough of. I know just enough to know what to Google.
Right.
And that's about it. Tabletopia and Vassal are two of the big ones. So Vassal's like a free one. And Tabletopia is like some really nice components. But I think it's a subscription-based one. But we should do an entire episode just on that. And roll20.net is another one for like, I believe that's the free for role playing. And then Fantasy Ground is the subscription for role playing. It seems like there's like this premium service and free service for both of these things. So, all right, shall we move on? All right, here's the music.
In this episode, we're talking about bringing people into the hobby. Hopefully, we'll do better than the Onion article titled Explanation of Board Game Rules Peppered with Reassurances that it will be fun.
So we talked about this article a while back, and I figured this is like...
it was up on our Facebook, yeah.
This is the perfect thing. I'm going to read this article verbatim, and it's really quite small. It's just like one of those Onion blurbs. If you're not familiar with the Onion, it's a satirical newspaper. Now it used to be an actual newspaper. Now it's just only online. And they actually have videos and news, satirical news clips and stuff like that. Completely fictitious in all ways, but hilarious nonetheless. The full article goes like this. Repeatedly seeking to ease his friend's growing skepticism and disinterest, local man Joel Mayhew peppered his explanations of the rules of a board game pandemic with reassurances that it'll be fun, sources confirmed Friday. I know you'll really like it once we actually get going, said Mayhew, flipping through the game's instructions to clarify the rules while pausing frequently to promise that the game was much less complicated than it seemed. Okay, so basically, once you've completed the movement part of your turn, one option is to give or take a city card from another player. You'll get the hang of it, I swear. Although, and don't worry, if you forget this part, because I can just remind you, you can only share a city card with players who already are in the same city as you. Seriously, you're going to be addicted after we've played this game through a few times. At press time, two of Mayhew's friends had abandoned the game, and he was hastily reassuring those remaining at the table that it was actually more fun with fewer players. So,
in order to not be this person, what are some things that we can do?
I have lots and lots of feedback. Again, this is another place where the listeners are trusting us on this. We do have a little bit of input from Steve, Terrence, Michael, and Steven, but they're actually, let's start with that. So I think Steven's a good one to start. He said he was actually brought into gaming through a work group. A friend of his at work, you know, started saying, hey, we're going to do this gaming club. And then he came in and now he's bringing his son jumped right into it. And he's bringing his wife in using co-op games such as Pandemic and Forgotten Island. Forbidden Island. Yes. Forbidden, Forgotten. I need to just make a Forgotten Island game. So if I'm not right when I say it the first time, I'll make myself right. Anyone who knows me who's listening is like, yep, that sounds like Chris. Mm-hmm. Terrence cautions that you really can't bring someone into, like push someone into the hobby. You really have to lure them in by like leading them in with something they like or something you know. And we'll get to the other ones in a sec. But what do you guys think? Like, we've all been outside this hobby. Sydney, how did you get in the hobby?
I have not been outside this hobby. I basically started in multiple ways as a kid, and my philosophy is start them young, because I was an only child growing up, so my parents played a lot of games with me to try and teach me things that I would learn if I had a sibling, like waiting my turn, sharing, patience, being a good winner or loser, and none of those actually stuck, but they tried. And then it turned into my parents attending science fiction conventions, and when I was too old for the babysitting that was at science fiction conventions, they would drop me off at the game room and tell me they'd be back to pick me up for lunch. And that's not normally how babysitting ran, but I stayed there all day, every day, and played my way through being babysat.
So basically what you're saying is, parents, bring your kids into the hobby really early.
Oh, yeah.
Use the game rooms as babysitting groups. Mm-hmm. And then you don't have to worry about answering this question later.
Oh, totally.
I like it. It works for me.
All right. So I think you really, I mean, Spencer is sort of a gamer too, but he has more of like his core games that he likes to play. And I liked playing those ones with his friends when they'd come over if they needed an extra player. But it was really when we started living with you that you would get your new game and you needed someone to play with. And Kitty, you're right here. I just need you to do this for a minute. And that was like 2 hours later. You know,
so trickery works.
Ah, yes.
Depending on the person.
And illusion. And illusion.
Trickery and illusion. A little bit of an inside joke there, but you can... It's a quick question next week.
So, yeah, I think... also, kind of knowing what somebody likes. We've talked about this before. Trying to do like branded games are a really fun way if somebody loves Harry Potter. I mean, my family had every single Harry Potter themed game ever growing up. So, you know, I had already gotten very familiar with game systems because everyone in my family is a huge Harry Potter fan. So we played, you know, Harry Potter Clue and Harry Potter Trivia. And, you know, now they've got so many more better Harry Potter games that I can bring back to my family and get them more into this.
Well, Harry Potter Clue is nice because at least it adds a little bit more to Clue. Mm-hmm. But like Harry Potter Trivia, it's basically Trivial Pursuit with Harry Potter.
We really liked there's the Hermione mechanic, where if you knew the answer and somebody else didn't and you had one of these cards, you could say Hermione and wait for them to answer. And if they got it wrong and you knew the right answer, you could steal their points.
All right.
So that was a new, that was something different. And sometimes we'll do this like in a conversation. We're like, I'm just going to wait for you to fail. Shout out Hermione.
That'd be good.
Right, I've seen it. They do that.
How did you get into gaming?
I don't know. I see, I've kind of been in and out of gaming several times. I think I'm in gaming when I find, you know, a game or two that I enjoy and I'm around a group of people that I can play it frequently. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I played a lot of like the classic family mass market games when I was a kid. And when I was in high school, started playing like, you know, the Dungeons and Dragons kind of games and Settlers of Catan, that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. So I'd say that high school stuff and really living with you is probably the two times I got.
Really I remember during the trick taking segment, you were talking about playing that when you were a kid too.
Oh, Spades.
Yeah. Spades is a huge game in Spencer's family. Mm-hmm. Every get together, there's at least one game going on.
Yeah.
So we all come, and my background is same thing. I grew up in the 80s, which was mass market games. Lots and lots of Monopoly, Risk, Yahtzee. I think people call it Farkle. We called it Ones and Fives. So just like rolling Farkle. Dice.
Yeah.
And you get 50 points for fives and 100 points for ones, or I don't know what the score goes, but
I only ever played this with you at Temple Stowe that one time. Yeah. So I'm not real clear on the rules.
But it's an actual game. And then I got into role playing in middle school. I ended up finding a guy who would teach me Dungeons and Dragons. I'm like, teach me this game. And he was the nerdiest guy in school. And so I figured he'd know. So I went up to him and was like, hey, do you know how to play Dungeons & Dragons? He's like, yeah. I'm like, can you teach me? He's like, yeah. And we became best friends all through middle school and high school, just basically centered around that. There weren't a lot of board games to play at that time, though, outside of the mainstream stuff. It's like you didn't really go into board games. There was a couple, like Dungeon had just come out, which was kind of based on Dungeons & Dragons. But all of these things were what we would call today as roll and move games. Mm-hmm. So you roll the dice and you move a number of squares and see what happens. Not the most inventive mechanic, but everybody knew it. Like, Sorry was like that.
Monopoly.
Parcheesi.
All these roll and move. Even backgammon's a roll and move game. There's just strategy to how you move.
There's strategy to which pieces you move.
Right.
Even, I'd say, in all of them, where you have four or more pieces, usually four with Sorry, Parcheesi, that kind of thing, it's which of my pieces do I want to move? Trouble, even, falls into that category.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I started with that kind of stuff. And then I kind of got, I played Magic in college and then said, actually I played Magic in high school and then got out of it in college because it got, I wanted to be a college kid. So I kind of got out of gaming completely for a while. When I came back again through Dungeons and Dragons, where it's like, okay, now I'm playing this Dungeons and Dragons thing again. We're playing at game stores and I'm seeing all these other cool games on the shelves. Then I started, I think I was playing 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons before I ever played Settlers of Catan, which is like what most people would consider like that quintessential gateway game at the time, which was like the mid-90s? No, I guess it was late 90s.
Like, I would say 2000s.
Right. Early 2000s.
Early 2000s.
Early 2000s, yeah. Somewhere in that range. Because I was definitely, it had to be early 2000s at that time. So then I'm like, oh, Settlers of Catan, that's interesting. So played that. I'm like, oh, I like this game. This is fun. And then I started playing other things like Dominion, which is, you know, a deck building game that we've talked about, which Sydney and I were just talking today. We need to get a copy of the second edition so that we can make you two actually play the game.
I've gotten a lot of my friends into gaming through Dominion. All throughout college, it was super easy as a college kid to only own one game and be able to teach people how to play. And then once they got really excited about playing the first version, you still have the same box with the same cards in it. And you just take out another set of 10 and you have a new game.
Yep. So, those kind of games made me like fall back in love with game design because I'd actually gotten out of the video game industry by that point. So it's like, there's all these cool game design elements that I can go through and find in board games that I was missing from doing the video game stuff. So this leads us to how do we bring people in that maybe don't have the same background? So we all have some kind of gaming background, but I think across the board, you would have a hard time finding someone who's never played Monopoly.
Yeah, I agree with
that. Yeah. I think that sometimes that can be a detriment, though.
It can, because that's what people think board games are. Mm-hmm. So how do you get past that?
Well, my first reaction when somebody tells me Monopoly is I kind of cough and laugh and giggle a little bit and be like, no. But then after that, I think honestly telling them you're going to have more fun than if you played Monopoly, or you're going to have something that is more interesting or something that you really, really want to play rather than something you're just going to play because it's the board game.
What if they love Monopoly, though?
Well, then
you say this is just like Monopoly.
Yahtzee.
Just like Yahtzee.
Yeah.
You're going to love this.
This is just like Yahtzee. It's so much fun. You'll love it.
Yep. I think you need to be a little careful on kind of like you said, and for you, it works. For me, if I was to make fun of somebody for playing Monopoly, it might not come across as well. Right. So you kind of want to say, oh, what did you like about Monopoly? Well, you know, it's not really nothing. I'm like, great. I have a game that actually is fun, you know, or they're like, well, I really like the negotiation aspect of it. Okay, awesome. I have a game that you're going to love. I really liked, you know, trading and the money and becoming king of everything. Great. I have a game that you're going to love, because we have all kinds of games that do everything Monopoly does just better. I think theme is also one of those things we need to look at when we're teaching somebody or bringing somebody into the hobby. Don't pick, and you guys should agree or disagree with me on this, but I'm thinking don't pick something with a strong theme. Pick something generic, unless it's licensed. Like if it's a licensed Harry Potter or Star Wars, maybe, but even Star Wars is probably over the head of most people who like Star Wars.
Well, I disagree with that on two levels. So I think some games, it's easy to think someone's going to like it because it has a theme that speaks to their interests, right? Like the Harry Potter and everyone in your family thing. That works for some people. And for some people, it can totally backfire, right? Because there's all kinds of like branded versions of Monopoly, right?
Right.
If we're going to keep banging on Monopoly, you know how bad that is. It doesn't make the game any more fun that you've got, you know, Star Trek characters on it or whatever it is. So you can't, I don't think you can bank on that too much.
Right.
But it can be helpful. Right. If it's the little bit of the extra carrot that you need to get somebody interested, as long as the game itself is actually going to be fun. The second point, though, sorry, because it was a two pointer. The thing more, though, is I think going in with this idea of like, well, I'm going to lure you in with this generic game. It's like there's a long term ambition there of like, I'm going to transform you into someone who has a different lifestyle.
Or yeah. You're and that's what Chris's aim is.
Yeah. Sure. And I get that, but I think people might pick up on that.
Maybe. I want to hear what Kitty has to say.
So I think that it's a double-edged sword. You can go both ways with it. You have to really know the person and know the game. If they're going to be someone who gets caught up on the theme, then yeah, going with a generic game is fine. Like if they're sitting there going like, I don't understand how this has anything to do with space exploration, you know, maybe that's, you know, you find something a little bit.
I've never met anyone who does stuff like that.
No.
It's me. But if it's, you know, somebody who's like, oh, I just want to focus on the rules, getting to learn the game and like, you know, yeah, sure. It's terraforming Mars, but you know, I'm learning the rules of the game, really, not focused on that one. Although I think Terraforming Mars might not be your best choice for
introducing
someone.
Well, the reason I was thinking about this is because if you look at a game, theme has the ability to turn people's imagination on. It also has the ability to turn people's imagination off or be put off by something.
Yeah,
I love anything fantasy themed, but I am a gamer. And I'm a nerd, and I like fantasy movies, I like science fiction, I like all that stuff. So if I see a game that is that, yes, that's going to draw me in. But if I want to get a coworker's wife to play a game, because they're over for dinner at some point, I don't know what that person is really into and what is off-putting to them. If I was to pull out something that's a little bit more generic themed, like Uwanu, which is the Egyptian card game we were talking about.
Or Splendor.
Or Splendor. That's something that is such a neutral, bland theme that you can't really be put off by the theme alone. Then you can just look at the mechanic of the game and say, and Splendor's a great one. We've done that with both my parents and Sydney's
parents.
You know, we sit down, let's play a game, pull out Splendor, because it takes you about 2 minutes to explain. And from that point on, there's nothing off-putting about it. When you look at something like Spades or any 52-card card game, nobody is put off by that theme. You just teach them the rules and they're good to go. And I think that's a good way to pull someone in. Now, if I was to say, because we were talking about trick games, and one of the games that I bought, I think it's called Dwarves. And it is a trick-taking game that has like fantasy dwarves. You know, good enough. If I take that to somebody who's not really into fantasy, maybe that's what's going to be blocking them from pulling this in. But there's another trick-taking game called Diamonds, which is really just a deck of cards that has like different suit powers where you're collecting diamonds and they're little crystal things. Very, very generic theme. I think that brings people, that it's less off-putting to people.
But if you have somebody who loves outer space and you know that they're really into astronomy, maybe Moons is the trick-taking game you pull out because it does have that fun theme. Yeah. And they'll be like, oh, look, I know all these moons. And like, it's something to bring them in. So it's knowing your audience. And if you don't know the person very well, go generic. But if it's somebody who you know, like, oh, this person loves Egypt and, you know, reads all these books about Egyptology, pull out Imhotep. Imhotep, it's a really fun game where you've got these like fun little Egyptian things going on.
And I think actually Egypt is a generic theme. It's something that is a historical theme, but it's non-offensive historical.
I don't know. I mean, it turns out how heavy it's laid on.
Sure.
Right. I mean, what was the game we were speaking about earlier that we first brought up that we couldn't pronounce the Inu?
Now you're making me remember either. Like Abominable.
Uanu.
Yeah. That sounds like that's a real generic level, right?
Right.
I mean, you could have a game that's an in-depth exploration of ancient Egyptian history and governmental and religious structure, right? And that's just all context on the game, and that's not generic anymore.
Actually, that's a great point.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, finish up.
That's a great point, because when you're bringing somebody into gaming for the first time, you want to make sure that the exceptions to the rules are minimal, like practically none. We talked last week about rule books and how sometimes the cards, like Magic the Gathering or Codex or something, all the exceptions are on the cards. That is not a good game to bring someone in on. So very simple, streamlined rules. I don't want to say mainstream, because it doesn't have to be mainstream, but something where this is the rule set, this is how you play. And there are very few exceptions to that rule set.
Yeah, I mean, the mainstream's mainstream for a reason, right? It's got a lot of universal appeal. They're trying to sell to a lot of people. A lot of people have to be able to approach it quickly without someone actively persuading them to like it, right?
Yep. And sometimes it already has become so superly successful. So you know that it's already reached an audience that will teach it to others. And then that's how you're reaching more people with that game.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. So I think that's probably brings us to a broader point that you can look at mainstream games and say and see like what about this appeals to people, and that can kind of help you bring new people into, I guess, maybe more serious, if that's what you want to call it, games.
Yeah.
When I was in Barnes & Noble recently, I actually saw Mysterium there, and that's not a game that when I was younger I would have expected to see at a Barnes & Noble, because I was just super excited to see games that like we've put to the table and played multiple times in a game store. Well, Barnes & Noble isn't a game store, but it's turning into having a robust gaming section.
It does have a very robust gaming section. I was just there the other day too. We're big readers as well as gamers here, so it is growing. It's a hobby that's growing. So, you know, you can also kind of play on that like fear of missing out that people have sometimes, is like, this is going to be huge. You're going to see this in a few years. Everyone's playing this.
Be the cool kid.
Be the cool kid. Get in on this with me.
Yep. So we talked.
I wouldn't work that angle too hard. I mean, let's be honest.
Be part of the beginning of the hobby. So we talked about the games that you might use to bring people into the hobby. Now let's, like, the techniques we might use. So I briefly talked about work gaming groups. I think it was, Stephen mentioned that he had started a group, or he had been pulled into a group at work. I think Michael or Steve also may have mentioned that, you know, they kind of have this group at work. And I think this is a good place to start, especially, so I work in tech. It's not that hard to find someone who's probably interested in gaming in some way, shape, or form. But most of the office is not. You know, so it's like, yes, I can find someone easy enough. But if a couple of us get together and say, hey, let's have a game night on Tuesdays, and we're playing in a conference room that is open so people can see what we're doing, you get people stopping by asking questions. Hey, what's going on? It's like, oh, yeah, we're just doing our game night. If you want to stop by next week, come on in and we'll, you know, show you how to play whatever game we're playing.
I think that one of the things that makes it easy for other people is if you, as the gamer, make it as logistically easy as possible. So in that kind of situation, you own the game. They don't have to buy it. You bring it to work. They don't have to go anywhere. You teach them the rules. You set it up as easy as possible for them. And they're just expecting a fun night. And they don't have to actually think about all these other things that may prevent them from sitting down in the first place.
Well, you played... You had a euchre tournament at work.
Oh, yeah. It was fantastic. It was really great. We ended up, some other people set it up, so it was easy for us. And we just took maybe half an hour at lunch to our pairs would meet and play the game, and they would set up the bracket. And it was a lot of fun. And it was encouraged because it actually helped us all meet each other within the different departments. As an accountant, I really never actually got out and talked to the people upstairs doing the dirty work other than when I was billing their invoices. And so getting randomly paired with people to then randomly play against two other people, it really actually helped the company, which was a good thing for all of the individual departments.
Yeah, I think that's great if you're lucky enough to have a job that's conducive to that, right? And it's great, but I think a lot of listeners probably don't.
I was going to point out, I don't work in an office. No. I don't have my desk is always covered in art projects. I only have a couple coworkers at the building where I work. And, you know, I know them and I know that I'm not going to be able to get them to sit down for very long. And especially, they're not going to hang around after their shift is up.
Yeah. So, I mean, you were talking earlier about how when you first got into gaming, it was really kind of grade school and high school, right?
Right.
And work is, it's the school of adulthood.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. And how did you do that at school? You met people at school, but it's not like you were sitting down, for most people, you weren't sitting down playing in the middle of class, right? you'd hang out outside of school.
Lunch.
You'd get together and yeah, maybe lunch. So I think that might be a formula that you can kind of follow.
Yep. So right, you take it outside of the workplace. So now we have board game parties. Now,
I would even start it with just have a regular old dinner party.
Yes.
And then pull out a game at the end of the night. Like, oh, hey, we finished eating dinner. Let's this is a really easy entry level game that we're just going to do this real quick. If we don't like it, we don't have to play more than one round.
Yeah. And that type of thing, like having just a couple people over. So I say the word board game party because I think that a lot of people think that this is a good way to introduce new players. I actually think it's a really bad.
Scary.
I do too.
It's very intimidating.
Yep.
Yeah.
So if you're going to do a board game party, you're inviting over presumably more than four people. Because your typical board game is going to play four. Depending on the game, you might play up to seven. Once you get past seven, you're playing party games.
Mm-hmm.
So board game parties kind of, I'm going to say degrade into party games, which is fine. Party games are their own thing and they're fun, but they're not like strategic,
right,
put a board game on the table type of thing. But having a couple over from work, or, you know, even if you're just working, it's not a couple's things, you're single. It's like, hey, Joe, Frank, and Barbara, why don't we get together at this bar down the street from me and have a few drinks?
Guthrie's.
It just happens to be a board game bar that we can go grab, you know, a few games off the shelves and play on there. See how that goes over. Oh, if you guys really like this, I have a few games back at my place. That sounds like a creepy date, but it can, but it can work. So kind of like test out the waters by getting people out of the workplace. And this works not only in a workplace. You can do this at college as well if you don't have college clubs you're going to. School, you know, it's like you always have friends over and stuff. Oh, come on over. We're going to play Pokemon on the Game Boy or whatever the kids do these days.
Pokemon Go, Chris.
Pokemon Go, sorry. But then you pull out the Pokemon card game, you know, and you kind of – like you can get that as a group as well. Or, hey, family night. Like that's a big thing too. Have the friends over. My parents and I have a board game night on Tuesdays. You want to come over and play? Sure. You know, and that allows you to kind of branch that out. And I'm not just talking like, you know, preteen levels. Like this is teenager level.
Mm-hmm.
Game nights are still a thing.
And creating game nights with your family, if you don't already have it, that's a fantastic audience right there because they have to listen to you sometimes. Yeah. And you can teach them all of these things I didn't learn as a child, how to, you know, share, wait your turn, and you can do those with games even if they haven't tried them yet.
Yep.
Cooperative games are also really, really fun and really a great way to pull people in because you feel like you're working as a team. Sometimes when you're playing a competitive game and you're bringing somebody in, they feel like, I'm still learning the rules. You're really good at this already. I'm just going to sit here and lose.
Yep.
And that's not fun. And when you're playing a cooperative game, there's a point to like coming together to like, you know, beat this thing, and like you're working with each other. You can give advice that's actually helpful. And this happened to us the other day. We were playing Burke's Gambit, and Chris is trying to give advice to the general table. Like, so if you're trying to play this role, this is what you want to do. And I felt like it was just outing me if I did what Chris was saying a bad guy should do. Doesn't that just mean I'm admitting I'm a bad guy? I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. And it was very frustrating for me.
Because it was competitive.
And I felt like I was losing because Chris was trying to be helpful. And it was really very like, ah. But if you're playing a cooperative game, you're playing Pandemic or something like that, you know, Chris's advice, there's no reason he's giving you bad advice.
Yeah, I think it's definitely safer in the co-op zone for that. But I think there's still a risk if you get people on very different wavelengths, right? Some say you've got the majority of the board or maybe one or two people are taking the game really seriously and you've got, you know, a newbie, doesn't know what they're doing. You might end up feeling like you're not even playing because
if you're playing with me, an alpha player, you might have a very hard time getting a turn where I don't ask you, is that really what you want to do?
Right. And then it's just all you're doing is just you feel like you're just a placeholder. You
so
know?
Remember, we're the ones bringing them into the hobby. So let them make those choices. And that's something we get to decide. I want to bring this person into the hobby. I don't want to play the game for them. I may lay out a couple options and just say, but it's your call. Whatever you do, it's going to be fine. It's, you know, it's just a game. And some people will be happy just taking a back seat and saying, well, what do you think is best? Like, I'd probably do this. Okay, then I'll do that. Fine. Some people are more comfortable doing that until they get the hang of the game. And then they're like, okay, I want to play that again. Like, that happens all the time. Someone might look like they're not having fun, but really they're just observing what's going on. And they're like, let's play that one more time. I'm like, really? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, oh, okay.
I also think you guys are referencing a little bit maybe some of the more timid audiences, because I actually have some friends who are super into video games and they're already really competitive and they're a lot of fun to play games with, because we've gotten them to play games by knowing that they really want to win and they want to learn the rules and mm-hmm. they want to know these things, but maybe just haven't had the outlet to play board games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say that, again, if you know the person you're trying to bring in, it's a lot easier. I'm always kind of thinking of the person I don't know, or at least don't know well enough to focus on that. So there's a few questions you can ask. What kind of board games have you played in the past? Do you like video games? What kind of books or movies do you like? Is sitting down with a group of people something that you're not comfortable doing? What kind of beer do you like? You know, these are important things to know, because that's another way to lure someone in. It's like, it's just a bunch of friends sitting around a table throwing dice while drinking beer.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are like, yeah, that sounds fun. You know, everyone knows, has that picture in their head of playing cards. You know, it's the same kind of idea that you're trying to get them in on.
I want to give a shout out to Pyramid Arcade.
Yeah.
That is a great game to pull out. And then just like, ask them like, okay, what are some of your favorite video games? Because there's going to be normally, like, especially an arcade game, you know? Do you like Pac-Man? Do you like Tetris? Like, what do you like? Are we doing puzzles? Are we, you know, moving around the board? What do you like? And there's something in there that's going to get to what they like to do.
Actually, it just made me think of, there's a new craze of board games right now, which I don't even know if you can call them board games, but they kind of are. And that's escape room games.
Yes.
Yes.
So there's at least three different main brands of them and then a few offshoots here and there. Getting someone to play an escape room, that, again, it requires just saying, okay, we're going to sit down and we're going to concentrate on this for 60 to 120 minutes or so. But people will get involved in that. People love to like solve puzzles and work together. And again, it's a cooperative thing. So that's another really easy way to get someone involved.
Yeah.
But I do think cooperative games still get to the competitive spirit because you still want to win.
Yep.
But it's you're like, winning together.
It's like, no, we're not going to use a clue. That'll bump our score down by one star. We're going to figure this out.
Or if you have someone like me who has a really hard time cutting any piece of a game, you just like hand it to Chris, look away, and he'll cut it so that it actually works for the clue.
Yeah, a lot of these escape rooms are non-resettable. So you play them once, and they're kind of, you're done. Not all of them. Some of them you can reset, but you still wouldn't be able to play them yourself again because you'd give that to someone else. So you're looking at maybe anywhere from $15 to $25 to play a game that you're only going to be able to play once. But that experience is still cheaper than going to a movie.
Yeah.
And it's so engaging.
It almost reminds me of those like murder mystery party games that they used to. We tried to do them in high school and they never worked out very well. The escape rooms work so much better.
They do. Now, I do want to mention a few things. So we've been talking about people that we know or friends of friends or something like that. There are times where we'll be at open gaming or maybe we're playing at a bar that normally wouldn't have games and maybe we're looking for someone else to join us or be willing to let someone else join us. Playing at a convention. Here, everybody's playing games, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're four people sitting down and you're not ignoring the world, it's someone who may want to join you and who you may want to game with, they're not necessarily going to approach you. So this is kind of being aware of who you are. So right now, we're sitting down. We're four white people playing a game. Mm-hmm. And if somebody walks up, and they're not one of us, right? They're not going to, they may not feel invited, especially if we don't look up and acknowledge them. Now, we have two women at the table right now, but if it was Spencer and I and two of our other guys and we're just sitting there and ignoring the world, again, it's not a very inviting situation. So I just.
There's nothing less inviting than white guys.
There's nothing. Nothing. There really isn't. Yeah. And even if you're the most friendly white guys on the planet, it's still too easy for you just to kind of get locked in what you're doing. And someone else coming up, they may not feel comfortable asking, hey, what's going on? So if you're in a public group and you want people to join you, open up a little bit. Back the chairs up a little bit. Look around. Make eye contacts with people that, you know, are looking at what you're doing. And be willing to explain what you're doing. Be willing to say, hey, want to sit down and, you know, we started about an hour ago. We have about an hour to go, but by all means, pull up a chair. We can talk you through how to play it. So, you know, if you want to play again when we're done, we can maybe start over or something like that. You know, just be aware of that presence and
have that empty seat at the table that somebody's willing to fill.
Yeah.
And if you know you're playing in public, pick a really cool looking game with like awesome art or like weird shaped pieces. So like people have something to ask about when they walk by and see you playing.
Yep. And if you are that person walking by, don't be so overbearing. You know, it's fine to sit there, you know, stand there, watch, take a look. And hopefully someone at the table looks up and says, oh, hey, we're playing such and such. Or kind of wait. I have had a few people that have been like, they'll come over. Or they'll be playing a game that they have played. They'll come over and they'll either talk about how bad it is or how, oh, that strategy, if you're doing this, you just want to do that. And they kind of take that game over too.
Dominion's a fantastic example of that. If you see something of the 10 cards and these people are halfway through playing their game and somebody walks by and says, oh, you should have this, this, and this. Well, kind of halfway through my game already.
Right. So that invitation and that openness plays on both sides. If you want to find a group that you want to continue playing with, or you want to lure somebody into something that you really love, be open to bringing in anybody. And I just want to mention that because I think this is one of those things where I've seen it happen over and over and over again, where people just aren't aware of what's going on outside of the game.
Mm-hmm. People don't respond well to like negative jerks that tell them that they're dumb. Yeah. And their interests are bad and you did that wrong.
Yep. Yeah, pretty much. Or a big sign saying, don't talk to us. We're awesome and you're not. Yeah. I'd actually get a t-shirt made up of that. It just only goes on the back, though. So you don't. It's a plain front, but on the back it says, don't talk to me.
You have a smiley face on the front. Something really inviting. On the back it'll be like, I secretly can't stand this person I'm talking to. Yeah.
I hate everyone in front of me. All right. Do we have anything else to add? Michael did mention that. He's taught a lot of, he goes around and teaches games. He did mention that on college campuses, getting people to play a game of Werewolf is actually pretty easy.
Oh, yeah.
That's one way. A bunch of people having fun that will lure people in.
Have fun. That's a good idea.
Yep. Steve mentioned that he moves around a lot. So when he goes to a new location, he'll host like a monthly board game you know, meet up at his place and just see who wants to come. He also carries around a simple card game so that he's always ready to play a game if somebody's like, oh, yeah, if only we had a simple card game to play.
Oh, well, look what I have here.
Boom.
I think a last thought from me would be have patience. If you're bringing someone in and you've picked out this really cool game you think they're going to love because you've tailored it to them exactly and they don't get caught up in that. Be flexible. Allow yourself to change the game if you want to continue trying. If they're open to trying another game, don't cut yourself off because you've put something in front of them they don't like and you are flustered.
Yeah. Don't be elitist. I don't like Cards Against Humanity. For the longest time, I didn't like Pandemic. Sydney still doesn't. If someone wants to play Cards Against Humanity and that's what it takes to get them to play a game, though, I'm going to play it. Someone wants to play... I don't know. There's not a lot of games I really dislike right now. But games that I've like maybe overplayed. Like I really like Codenames, but it's not my go-to game. But Codenames is another really...
What about Monopoly? Would you play Monopoly?
I would actually play Monopoly. What I would try to do with Monopoly, though, is play it by the written rules. Because I've never done that.
Ooh.
So I have no idea how to perform an auction Monopoly. I just know that you're supposed to. So we'll see. We'll talk more about that next week, though.
I think you could write a whole sociology paper about Monopoly.
Oh, yes.
It's interesting how much culture is built up around this game.
There are probably a lot of papers written on it.
Yeah.
And a number of podcasts I've listened to covering Monopoly. So, yeah, I think that those are good tips. Like, and again, Codenames is a good one. Don't be elitist. That's where I was going. play games that you wouldn't normally play to bring someone new in. And then say, also, if you like this, you'll probably really like this other game, too.
Mm.
You know, kind of do those segues.
Yeah.
All right. On to our post-topic section. Again, it's been a relatively slow week. I blame the holiday weekend. No iTunes reviews. I think Kitty's going to win. We're not going to get to 70 before Origins. But let's all prove Kitty wrong. We just need 10 reviews in the next 3 weeks. No problem. I like it. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our Facebook is /Tabletop Game Talk Podcast. Twitter is @TabletopGameTLK. Or you can follow me @GameMasterChris. If you're interested in our Patreon, then you can find out all kinds of information about our Patreon at TabletopGameTalk.com/Patreon. We are currently attempting to get up to our giveaway a month goal, which we're doing anyway. But after that, we will be going towards a goal to start giving a portion of the proceeds to charity that helps other gamers. And I'm looking at the Jack Vassil Memorial Fund as that charity that I want to start giving money to. And I think that is it. Do we have any other post-show announcements?
I don't think so.
All right. Again, follow us because I don't know what's going on with Origins yet, but as soon as I do, I'm going to tweet it. So, all right, Kitty / filling in for Josh. This was really quiet in the last episode, so I'm going to try to... There we go.
Thanks for listening.
Music. I like it.
Thanks for listening. And remember, we love your feedback, so consider leaving us an iTunes review, email us with comments or questions at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com. Finally, a huge thanks to our patrons, Emil Jiljam, Shane Poole, George, Adam Harrison, Sam from New York, Tom Bly, Jason Strong, Terrence Miltner, Steven Seitz, Alex Brown, Michael Ohl, Josh Arntz, Trevor Olson, Brian Arnold, Sean Kelly, Joseph Lee, John Merkel, Daniel Shepard, C. Marie, Rudy Liu, Benjamin Heimowitz, Jerry Huang, Mike Smith, and Stefan Phillips. Until next week, where we talk about game variants and house rules, keep playing games and having fun.
Good night.
So now we all need to play a game of Cards Against Humanity.
No, we're going to play Spades.
No!